Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson. Today we're doing something a little different. We're unpacking a single monumental 24 hours in American governance. The title for this deep dive is The Federal News Update for Saturday, December 20th, 2025.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. You sent over a mountain of source material, and our mission today is to really give you a thorough, exhaustive, granular look at what happened on December 19th.
It's just staggering, the sheer volume and, more importantly, the synchronization of it all.
Right. This wasn't a random series of events. This was a massive coordinated shift. We're talking about executive actions, huge court developments, industrial policy, all happening at once. It feels like a really critical moment for understanding how governance is operating right now.
Exactly. So we need to break down not just what happened, but how. How are these actions executed, and what are the long-term structural implications for the country?
I think we have to start with the biggest headline, which is healthcare. The executive branch just completely reshaped major aspects of healthcare policy and, frankly, flexed its administrative muscle in a way we haven't seen in a long time.
Okay, so let's jump in there. The pharmaceutical policy. It really feels like a masterclass in using one area of government power trade to achieve a goal in a totally different area.
It really is. The administration finalized agreements with 9 of the biggest pharmaceutical companies on the planet. I mean, you look at the list, it's a who's who. Amgen, Boehringer Ingelheim, Bristol Myers Squibb.
Genentech, which is part of Roche, Gilead, GSK.
Right. Merck, Novartis, Sanofi. It's basically everyone. It covers almost all the key players in global pharma.
And the core of the deal is this mechanism called Most Favored Nation Pricing. Or MFN.
Yeah, and for you listening, what that means is these companies are now forced to sell their drugs in the U.S. at the lowest price they offer to any other developed country.
So if Japan or Germany negotiates a drug down to, say, $10, the idea is that the American consumer now gets that same $10 price.
That's the theory. But the fascinating part, the truly revolutionary part, is how they did it. This wasn't a law from Congress.
Yeah.
It was the explicit threat of a trade action. A blanket 10% tariff on all of these manufacturers' products.
Wait, so not just on the one high-cost drug they were negotiating, on everything?
On everything, their entire global portfolio. So if you're Merck, they're threatening to tax your cancer drugs, your vaccines, your veterinary medicines, everything.
Right.
And that completely collapses the line between trade policy and domestic health policy. A 10% tariff across your entire product line is an existential threat. It's so much bigger than the profit margin on one or two drugs.
It forces them to just agree. There's no real room to negotiate or sue. You just take the deal.
You take the deal. It's an immediate, non-litigable surrender to the pricing demand. The administration's argument, of course, is that America has been subsidizing R&D for the rest of the world for decades.
The free-riding argument, that other countries with price controls force U.S. patients to foot the bill.
Exactly. And this MFN mechanism is designed to force that back to parity. And the scope is huge. This isn't for niche drugs.
No, it's for the big ones. High-cost chronic care drugs.
We're talking about treatments for type 2 diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis.
Asthma. COPD, hepatitis B and C, HIV, even certain cancers. These are drugs millions of Americans rely on every single day.
And the numbers they're citing are just wild. They give this example of Amgen's cholesterol treatment, which could drop from $573 down to $239.
A GSK inhaler down to $89. And the most dramatic one, a Sanofi blood thinner going from $756 down to $16.
$16. It's just a profound potential cost saving for people.
But there's always the question of the middleman, right? How do you make sure that savings actually gets to the patient?
Oh, well, that's where the second part of this comes in. The White House also announced the launch of this Trump RX platform.
Okay, so what is that?
It's a direct-to-consumer distribution platform. The idea is that these 9 companies have to offer these new, deeply discounted prices directly to patients through this website.
Ah, so it's a strategic move to bypass the pharmacy benefit managers, the PBMs, and the wholesalers.
That's the entire goal. Disintermediate the supply chain. In theory, if the manufacturer sells directly to you, the savings can't get absorbed by a middleman.
But there has to be a catch. There always is.
And it's a big one, a huge structural caveat. Injectable drugs and infusion medications are explicitly excluded from Trump RX.
Okay, so the most advanced, expensive drugs, biologics, why?
The stated reason is patient safety. They argue these are complex drugs that need to be administered by a professional.
Hmm.
But the economic reality is impossible to ignore. Biologics are the single fastest growing part of drug spending. They have the highest profit margins.
So the MFN pricing still applies to them for, say, Medicaid, but they're protected from this new direct-to-consumer platform.
Exactly. It protects the massive distribution profits for both the manufacturers and the PBMs on the most lucrative segment of the market. It feels like a classic political compromise. You know, tackle the visible cost of pills for chronic conditions, but leave the high-margin, complex treatments within the existing system.
And this isn't just a domestic policy. It's already having international ripple effects.
Immediately. The administration also revealed they cut a deal with the United Kingdom back on December 1st to make the UK increase the price of new drugs in their market by 25%.
Wow. So they're literally telling other countries, you have to pay more.
It's a stark confirmation of this sort of zero-sum view of global pricing. It's as if they're saying, if prices are coming down in the US, our allies have to pay more to make up for it. It sets a very aggressive precedent for future trade deals.
Okay, so that's one massive pillar of executive action. But at the same time, coming from the very same department, HHS, we saw a move in a completely different and deeply restrictive direction.
A parallel action, this one driven by Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and the CMS Administrator, Dr. Mehmet Oz. It targets gender-affirming care for minors.
And the first move was linguistic, a legal and semantic shift.
A huge one. They've completely banned the term gender-affirming care within the department. Instead, they've created this new term, sex-rejecting procedures, or SRPs.
And how do they define that?
The definition is very broad. Any pharmaceutical or surgical intervention that attempts to align an individual's physical appearance or body with an asserted identity that differs from the individual's
That's
sex.
a very loaded term. What's the legal strategy behind that framing?
Well, it's profoundly hostile to the medical consensus. By calling it sex rejecting, they're trying to preemptively undermine any legal claim that this is medically necessary care protected under civil rights law. The goal is to frame the care itself as inherently questionable.
And they rolled out a pretty complex, three-pronged attack to enforce this nationally.
The first prong is the big one. It's a national ban, essentially. They proposed a new rule for the hospital conditions of participation.
Or COP. And this rule would prohibit any hospital that receives Medicare or Medicaid funding from performing these procedures on anyone under 18.
And that's basically every hospital in the United States. They all depend on Medicare and Medicaid to stay afloat.
So even if you're a hospital in a state like California or Massachusetts that explicitly protects this kind of care, you'd have to stop.
Yes, or risk losing all your federal funding, not just for that one procedure, but for everything. Medicare payments, grants, everything. It's an existential threat that forces compliance.
It's an administrative maneuver that functions like a congressional ban, but without needing Congress.
Exactly. Then the second prong is more direct, a separate rule that prohibits states from using federal matching funds for these procedures for kids on Medicaid or CHIP.
And the third prong seems more subtle, but maybe just as important, is from the Office for Civil Rights.
Right. They proposed revising Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act to exclude gender dysphoria from the definition of disability unless it results from a physical impairment.
So that would strip away one of the main federal shields that advocates have used to sue for access to care. It basically closes a door to the courts.
It's a very comprehensive legal assault, and the public justification came from both Dr. Oz and Secretary Kennedy.
Dr. Oz cited concerns about irreversible harm, things like infertility, diminished bone density.
And Secretary Kennedy's focus was more on protecting children from being, in his words, pressured into decisions they cannot fully understand. So you have this combined front of medical concern and a kind of paternalistic protectionism.
What's really striking to me, though, with both the drug pricing and this SRP prohibition is the speed. I mean, these are huge controversial policies. For them to move this fast, something else has to be going on behind the scenes.
And there is. That brings us to what is, you know, it's arguably the most structurally important and definitely the most technical event of the day, and that's the fall of the Richardson waiver.
Okay, this is where we get into the administrative weeds, but it's critical to understanding the how.
It's everything. So back in 1971, the HHS Secretary, Elliot Richardson, he voluntarily subjected a whole category of HHS rules to the public notice and comment requirements of the Administrative Procedure Act, the APA.
And he had to do it voluntarily because the APA actually exempts rules related to things like federal grants, benefits, and contracts, right?
Correct. It was a good government move. Richardson basically waived that exemption to ensure more transparency, For 54 years, that's how HHS operated.
Until March of this year, 2025, when the current administration rescinded that waiver, calling it an unnecessary burden.
Exactly. So the key moment on December 19th was when the Senate tried to overturn that rescission. They voted on a resolution, SJ Res 82, and it failed. A 50-50 tie.
So the rescission of the Richardson waiver stands. What does that actually mean in practice?
It's monumental. It means HHS can now modify policies related to federal grants and benefits without any public notice, no comment period. They have, and this is the term people are using, unchecked discretion.
So the safety brake on the rulemaking car is gone.
It's gone. And the Senate just declined to put it back on. This is why they can move so fast on something like the SRP prohibition. They don't have to go through that long, laborious public process.
And what does that do for court challenges?
It cripples them. Courts rely on the administrative record, the public comments, the agency's responses to judge if an agency acted properly. Without that public process, the record is incredibly thin. It gives the agency a huge advantage in court and limits the ways a policy can be challenged.
So by failing to pass a resolution on a really obscure procedural rule, the Senate effectively handed the executive branch a massive new power.
That's it. It's a fundamental shift in the architecture of the administrative state. And this willingness to just bypass the old checks and balances, it's perfectly mirrored in what we saw happening in technology policy on the very same day.
A perfect segue. Let's pivot to what's being called the technocratic war. President Trump signed a presidential memorandum. Its title is pretty blunt: Winning the 6G Race.
No subtlety there. This is all about state-directed industrial policy and asserting technological dominance over rivals, mainly China.
And the core action is very specific. It's a mandate to immediately clear the 7.125 to 7.4 gigahertz spectrum band.
Right. And for you listening, that isn't just a random chunk of airwaves. It's widely considered the Goldilocks zone for 6G.
Why Goldilocks? What's special about it?
It's the perfect balance. It has the range to travel long distances effectively, but also the massive data capacity you need for these next generation networks. Securing this band first lets the U.S. set the global standard for 6G. It's a strategic move to control the architecture.
And the timeline is incredibly aggressive.
It's borderline unbelievable. Federal incumbents, and we're talking about critical military radar systems, NOAA satellites, scientific instruments, they have a strict 12-month deadline to submit plans to move out of that band.
A year. That's nothing in federal time.
It's an eye blink. And the memo is clear. This isn't about sharing the spectrum. It's about full displacement for full power commercial 6G use. The cost and complexity of moving those military systems on that timeline is just immense.
And the 6G push is explicitly tied to the administration's bigger AI agenda, which they're calling the Genesis mission. What's the connection?
Because next-gen AI isn't just something that lives in the cloud. They see 6G as the essential nervous system for real-time robotics, autonomous everything, and even what they call bio-digital convergence.
It sounds like implantable tech.
It implies that, yes. Without this cleared 7 gigahertz band, they believe that entire technological future is bottlenecked.
Now here's the really clever political part. They tied this whole 6G plan directly to the Working Families Tax Cuts Act.
That's the enforcement mechanism. It's the political leverage. The administration is planning to auction this newly cleared spectrum to generate the revenue to pay for those tax cuts.
So if they don't clear the band and auction it off quickly,
their entire fiscal agenda falls apart. It creates this incredible internal pressure to be ruthless about getting federal agencies out of that spectrum, no matter how difficult it is.
Okay, shifting from the digital frontier to the physical border, we saw equally fast, decisive action on immigration. And it was directly triggered by a recent event.
Yes, the recent shootings at Brown University and MIT. The suspect in that case allegedly got a U.S. visa through the Diversity Visa Lottery program.
So the administration's response was a proclamation that immediately suspends that entire program.
The whole thing. It's now on ice, pending a full security review. That program gives out about 55,000 visas a year to promote diversity and immigration, and now it's just paused indefinitely.
They also expanded travel restrictions with a new proclamation.
Proclamation 1949. And it's a severe expansion. The list of restricted countries is now up to 19.
And it includes some new additions, like Laos and Burkina Faso, on top of the ones you'd expect, like Afghanistan and Iran.
Right. And that signals a strategic shift. The criteria for being on the list isn't just about terrorism anymore. It's now about any country with weak identity management systems or unreliable information sharing. It's a much broader net.
On the other side of the immigration ledger, There was an announcement about the Trump Gold Card.
Yes, the fast-track residency program for the wealthy. The White House announced that sales have now hit $1.3 billion.
And that's from a $1 million fee for individuals and a $2 million fee for corporations, plus other fees.
Correct. And what's interesting is where that money goes. It's specifically directed to the U.S. Treasury to reduce the national debt. So it directly links this kind of wealth-based immigration to their core fiscal goal.
Okay, so from these big executive declarations, let's move to accountability, defense, and national security, because there was a lot of immediate action there, too, starting with the Pentagon.
Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth announced immediate military action in Syria. It's called Operation Hawkeye Strike.
And this was direct retaliation.
A declaration of vengeance was the phrase he used. It's a direct response to that attack on U.S. forces in Palmyra, Syria on December 13th. So this is immediate kinetic force projection.
But while that was happening overseas, there was this quieter crisis accelerating back home for the defense industry.
The CMMC reckoning. Cybersecurity maturity model certification. The deadline is coming up fast, and the entire defense industrial base is scrambling.
And here's the core of the problem. Industry estimates say only about 200 firms have actually been assessed and certified so far.
200. But the new rules mean that up to 80,000 firms will soon need Level 2 certification.
That's a staggering mismatch.
It's a huge problem. Level 2 is expensive. It takes over a year for many small companies to prepare for the audit, and there aren't nearly enough certified auditors, these C3 PAOs, to handle that volume.
So what's the consequence? A lot of small, specialized contractors are going to be locked out of DoD work.
They're already being locked out. The big prime contractors, your Lockheeds and Northrops, they're already starting to weed out subcontractors that aren't certified. They can't risk their own contracts.
So it's leading to a rapid consolidation of the supply chain.
It is, which ironically creates its own national security risks by creating more single points of failure.
And internally, the DoD is also trying to fix how it manages its own cyber workforce.
Yeah, there's been this long-standing concern that the different military services are basically inflating their self-reported readiness numbers.
So the Pentagon is shifting to a new model, the DoD Cyber Workforce Framework, or DCWF.
Right. It's an attempt to standardize how they define and qualify cyber talent based on the actual work someone is doing, not their job title.
And it broadens the definition of cyber work, doesn't it?
Critically, it expands it beyond just network security to include AI, data science, software engineering. The Pentagon knows that's the future of warfare, and they need a standardized way to measure their talent in those areas.
Okay, pivoting to accountability and the Department of Justice. A huge story here with the rolling release of the Jeffrey Epstein files.
Mandated by the Epstein Files Transparency Act, and it was controversial from the very first minute.
The Deputy Attorney General, Todd Blanche, came out and admitted they would not meet the midnight deadline to release all the documents.
Right. He said hundreds of thousands more documents were still to come over the next weeks and months. That immediate failure to comply drew fire from everybody. Chuck Schumer, Thomas Massie.
And on top of that, the documents they did release weren't searchable.
Which technically breaks a key provision of the law. I mean, releasing thousands of pages of non-searchable PDFs in this day and age, it's a deliberate obstacle.
And what was actually in the files that were released?
Highly sensitive stuff. Photos of former President Bill Clinton at a swimming pool with Ghislaine Maxwell on a private plane with another woman who's redacted. But everything was heavily redacted.
And Blanche's letter said they had identified over 1,200 victims or their relatives and redacted their names.
Yes, but the DOJ also tried to control the narrative immediately. Blanche asserted that their review found no credible evidence that Epstein was blackmailing prominent people.
Which a lot of people saw as the DOJ trying to get out ahead of the story before the public could even see the files.
Exactly. And they're also asserting common law privileges to withhold their own internal documents, which critics say goes way beyond what the law allows. It's setting the stage for a long legal fight over what transparency actually means here.
And while all this was happening, the courts were busy too. A federal judge was weighing President Trump's claim of immunity from civil lawsuits related to January 6th.
In the Levy Trump case, yes. And at the same time, the Supreme Court handed the administration a loss, forcing the president to face a free speech lawsuit brought by immigration judges.
So even as the executive branch is moving at this incredible speed, you see the judicial branch is still actively pushing back and defining the limits.
A classic separation of powers stress test, playing out in real time.
Okay, beyond those headline actions, The Senate was also busy before its recess, confirming key people. And Congress itself took steps to modernize its own operations.
Right. Let's start with the Senate confirmations. They filled some really critical roles. Edward Forrest is now the first permanent head of the General Services Administration, the GSA.
And he's a central figure in the administration's push for government efficiency, right?
Absolutely. His whole focus is on right-sizing the federal real estate portfolio and tackling this massive deferred maintenance backlog.
And that backlog number is just shocking. It's doubled since 2017, from $170 billion to $340
billion. $340 billion. It's the cost of just letting federal buildings fall apart. Force is trying to aggressively sell off underused properties and fix up the ones they keep, especially as they push for federal employees to return to the office.
There were also some key DHS confirmations. And finally, Adshead Amho, Kevin Lunday, was confirmed as Commandant of the Coast Guard.
That one had been held up by Senator Jackie Rosen over a specific policy issue. The Coast Guard had to remove language that described swastikas and nooses as merely potentially divisive from a policy document before she'd lift or hold.
Which shows you how detailed these confirmation fights can get.
Yeah.
But some pressure remains. Sean Plankey's nomination for CISA director is still on hold over related concerns.
Yeah, that's not over yet. But moving from confirmations to the workforce itself, one of the biggest internal shifts is happening at the IRS. They're going through their first major IT restructuring in over 20 years.
And it's a huge politically charged move. They're taking about 1,000 IT employees out of the CIO's office and moving them to the COO's office via directed reassignment.
And for those 1,000 employees, it's total chaos. They've been told they won't work on IT projects anymore and just have to upload their resumes and wait to be placed somewhere else in the IRS or Treasury.
The reporting says morale is at an all-time low.
Yeah, there's a quote from an employee saying the administration is getting what it wanted to destroy the IRS from within. So there's deep resentment.
But management's argument is that this is necessary pain for modernization.
That's the argument from the Treasury CIO, Sam Korkos. He says the current IT workforce just doesn't have the skills they need. He's also frustrated that the Federal Reduction in Force, or RIF, process is based on tenure, so they often lose their best young talent.
So this reorganization is their way of shaking up the whole structure.
Exactly. They're replacing the old structure with 4 mission-focused verticals, like taxpayer services, compliance, and 5 foundational tech areas. It's a very deliberate, very aggressive strategy to overhaul the agency's technical core.
Now, switching to Congress itself, the funding deal that ended the shutdown actually included some interesting measures to modernize the legislative branch.
Yeah, they're trying to address what they call the pacing problem, Congress's inability to keep up with technology. The first step is creating a legislative branch data map.
So basically a diagram of how all the information flows through Congress and its related agencies, like the GAO and CRS.
Right. You can't secure your data or prepare for AI if you don't even know where it all goes. You have to map it before you can defend it.
Then there's this pilot project, the Case Compass project.
I think this is fascinating. 50-member offices are in it. It anonymizes and aggregates all their constituent casework data into one big dashboard.
So a caseworker can see if a sudden spike in, say, passport delays isn't just happening in their district, but is a systemic national problem.
Exactly. It gives them the data to push agencies for systemic fixes, not just solve one-off problems. It really empowers the caseworkers.
And the last piece is more practical, but just as important for staff, a better congressional liaison directory.
Just a better phone book, essentially, but a critical one. Expanding the list of executive branch contacts to include people at regional offices and processing centers, not just in D.C. It can save a staffer hours of work.
And amidst all this partisan fighting, there was one moment of bipartisan reconciliation.
A very symbolic one. President Trump signed the Wounded Knee Massacre Memorial and Sacred Site Act into law.
This places land in South Dakota into a restricted status for the Oglala and Cheyenne River Sioux tribes.
And critically, the act explicitly prohibits any commercial development or gaming on the land. It cements its purpose as a memorial site, permanently.
Okay, before we get to the markets, there were 2 other quick administrative decisions that are pretty revealing.
Right. First, the State Department reorganized its procurement office, creating a new Bureau of Global Acquisitions.
This is about centralizing their buying power.
Yes, moving toward a category management model. So instead of hundreds of little contracts for IT, they have one big smart strategy for all IT procurement. It's part of that government-wide buy smarter push.
And the second thing was a court ruling about the Trade Agreements Act, the TAA.
This could be a big deal. The VA wanted to buy a blood thinner. They got one bid for a generic made in India, not a TAA-compliant country, and another for a brand-name version from allied countries that was much more expensive.
And the VA went with the non-compliant, cheaper one. How did they justify that?
They argued the price of the compliant one was excessively high, and so the exception applied. The court activity around this highlights this huge tension between getting the lowest price and sticking to trade deals that protect U.S. and allied manufacturing. It potentially opens a big loophole.
Okay, so with all of this happening, how did the markets and the economy react? Let's start with Fed Chair Jerome Powell.
Powell was testifying before the House Financial Services Committee, and the backdrop was not great. Black unemployment had hit 8.3%, the highest since 2021.
And under questioning, he made a really significant admission.
A pivotal one. He admitted that the Federal Reserve, by itself, with its monetary tools, cannot achieve full employment for Black Americans.
And that's huge, because it shifts the responsibility.
Completely. He's basically saying, my tools, interest rates, can't fix this structural problem. This is on you, Congress, and the White House to fix with fiscal policy, jobs, programs, taxes, spending.
So he's drawing a line in the sand between the Fed's job and the politician's job.
Absolutely. Now, despite all the upheaval, Wall Street was selectively optimistic.
And the major indices were all up. Dow up 0.4%, S&P up 0.9%, and the NASDAQ surged 1.3%.
And the driver was clearly the tech sector. Oracle was up over 5%, NVIDIA up 1.5%. Analysts directly tied that surge to the 6G spectrum memorandum.
So the market saw that memo as a guaranteed long-term federal commitment to building out AI and 6G infrastructure.
A state-directed supercycle for hardware and software. It de-risks the whole sector's future growth. It's a huge boost for companies like NVIDIA and Oracle.
And what about the pharmaceutical sector? Did it crash after the MFN news?
It didn't. And that's maybe the most fascinating part. It suggests that investors actually preferred the regulatory certainty, even if it was painful.
They'd rather take a known, calculated hit to their margins than live with the unknown risk of endless lawsuits or even harsher legislation down the road.
Exactly. Certainty over uncertainty. And one last signal on the economy. Consumer confidence.
Carnival Cruise Line.
Yeah, their stock jumped almost 10% after strong earnings and bringing back their dividend.
That's a really important barometer. It means that even as all this economic anxiety, the consumer leisure market is still very strong. People are spending on travel.
It suggests there are pockets of very high stability and confidence out there, despite the headlines.
So when we step back and look at the whole day, December 19th, what's the big takeaway?
I think it's the total mobilization and coordination of executive power. This was a watershed moment. It showed an incredible capacity for policy velocity.
They used every lever they had. Trade authority was a weapon to get domestic drug prices. National security was the justification to clear spectrum for commercial tech.
And most importantly, they dismantled those procedural protections, like the Richardson waiver, to give an agency like HHS just unchecked power to implement huge social policy changes at incredible speed with very little room for the courts to intervene.
The coordination of it all, economic, social, technological, administrative, it really does feel like the traditional checks and balances were put through their most severe stress test all on a single day.
So I think the final thought, the thing for you, the listener, to mull over as we head into 2026 is about that velocity. This institutional change is happening so fast. And the question becomes, what leverage is left for resistance?
When the executive branch can so successfully use both tariffs and obscure administrative rules to achieve its agenda, where do Congress and the courts find the room to effectively check the system?
Especially when the system itself has been re-engineered for maximum speed and execution.
What happens when speed becomes the policy itself? A really provocative question. Thank you for walking us through all of this. It was a monumental day.
It certainly was. Always a pleasure.
And thank you, the listener, for joining us on The Deep Dive. We'll talk to you next time.